If it works, if everything goes well
Love
today.
Talk Radio.
Right.
There it goes. Here it goes.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge. Get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis, and I'm your host, and this is MJ Network. Just to clarify something from the other day, I had to cancel the show because Blog Talk had some technical difficulties, and I apologize to Matt Coyle, and Matt Coyle will be on the show on December 18th with his new book, Wrong Light, and we'll do the book launch that day. Oh, well. But today we've got a phenomenal author. We have Jeff Bond. We have The Winner Maker. This is an original story. You know, I'm an educator, and I tell you, this is really great that these students, there's a 74-year-old dinosaur who's taught honor students and coached varsity football. He's missing. Now, what students in the world are going to go after and give up their whole life to find him? Well, the author is here, and I'm not going to tell you anymore. So good morning, Jeff, and thank you for doing this. I'm so excited.
Good morning, Fran. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here and talk about The Winner Maker with your audience.
Well, the title alone is fantastic. So explain, how come you decided on this particular title, The Winner Maker? And that's great because a lot of parents out there, they force their children to be number one, and my mother was one of them.
Right, right. And I think that's something that a lot of people have grown up with, you know, this culture of ambition and achievement. And our parents want us to you know, kind of have the best life that we can, and we want that for ourselves sometimes, but it can be a double-edged sword. The title, The Winner Maker, refers to the title character there, which is Bob Fisk, who is the 74-year-old dinosaur that you mentioned. He's a high school teacher. He's an honors senior English teacher as well as the varsity football coach at the high school, and he is a maker of winners, literally. He has a club that he calls the Winners Club. He taps a certain number of seniors from the high school class every year to be what he calls winners. It's kind of a secret club. He doesn't do it through the school, but he sends them a note outside of class. And it's the students that he thinks have the best chance to achieve and live big lives. And he uses it for him. It's a way to encourage them to go out there and make the most of their lives. For a lot of people, they believe that it can be destructive. And so a lot of the story, as the story unfolds, we kind of explore that theme of whether or not ambition is a good thing, or, you know, what are some of the downfalls that go with it.
Well, who comprises this team? Who are the members, and how are they chosen to be on this team? Because you just can't be anybody. You have to be
right.
Really smart than somebody.
That's right. Now, I think, you know, you might think, well, the winners would just be, you know, maybe the top 10 students scholastically,
yeah.
And certainly Fisk will choose some academic standouts, but he'll also choose people who maybe they're musically talented, maybe they're a great athlete. You know, anybody who he thinks is going to go out and leave high school and, you know, go to college and then become great in some way, you know, however you want to, you know, think about that. It could be, again, it could be musical. It could be that somebody has, you know, a writing talent, but he doesn't limit it to just scholastic. It's anybody who he thinks is going to go out there and make a huge impact on the world, however you want to define that.
Yeah, I know. So we have several students. We have Steph, who reminds me of me because when she wants to find something out, she doesn't give up until she gets the job done.
Right.
I was like, yeah, finally identified with somebody in the book. And then there's Becky, who my heart went out to. And then there's Eric, Lydia, and Autumn. How did you come up with all of these five people? I mean, they're all different. They're not the same. They all have different personalities.
Right. Right, very much. I mean, I think certainly whenever you start any book, I think you want to sit down and look at your characters and see how the balance looks. You know, do you have a good balance gender-wise? You know, do you have some introverts and some extroverts. And I certainly, you know, sat down and thought about, you know, what are the different types of winners that I wanted to put in the book. You know, I think some people have said that they feel like some of the characters fall into sort of stereotypes. You know, I kind of feel like they're archetypes. You know, they have, you know, Steph is kind of the prom queen, valedictorian, but there are a lot of things that humanize her and make her different than that type. Eric is kind of the sort of geeky tech guy who goes on to be a dot-com superstar. But, you know, he's also very emotional and has things that kind of take him away from that type. And so I sat down and maybe started with some of these types and some of these tropes that we think of when we think of people we knew in high school, and tried to play off of that and deviate from that as, you know, as the plot required. So they are all different types. And Becky is the one of the core mm-hmm. characters who's not a winner. You know, she's not somebody who had great scholastic success or some kind of extracurricular. But she, I think, as the story unfolds, we see that she's just got a really big heart and a good heart. And, you know, without giving away too much of the plot, she's pulled into some tough situations. And I think it was interesting for me, exploring the themes of ambition, to think about how she, as somebody who wasn't an achiever and an ambition and a win-at-all-cost character, how she, you know, attacked those situations versus the winners. And I think that's an important part of the story as it unfolds.
Well, Becky's mother is Nora. And why did she consider her different? And she didn't even have the faith in her to think that she was smart, and that bothered me.
Right. I think Jane Brockert is the mother of, she's got three daughters. And Jane was actually one of Bob Fisk's early students. So, you know, Bob Fisk is 74 years old. He's been teaching at this high school a long time. And Jane Brockert, way back in the early days of this Winners Club, just narrowly missed out on it. And I think that event for her was formative, and it provoked her wanting her daughters to have the thing that she didn't have. And so Nora Brockert was her oldest daughter. She dies in a prom night accident before the events of the story begin, and that death is something that's in the background of the story. And you're referring to the fact that Jane kind of pushed Nora to be a winner, and Nora resisted it at every turn, as I think some, you know, whenever you're a parent that pushes your kid hard, some kids it works for and some kids it doesn't. And Nora was somebody who just rejected it every turn. She dated boys from the wrong side of the track. She resisted, you know, studying and quizzes and things like that. And she's one of those people that just had a strong personality that wasn't going to be molded. You know, that's just who she was. And you know, mother and daughter in that way were just perhaps just tragically mismatched.
I know. My mother demanded perfection, and if I didn't get it, oh, boy.
Right. Yeah.
Actually, if I didn't get 100 on a test, I had to write it over, even if it was 99, so.
Oh, yeah, you know that kind of perfectionist streak, I know it. Yeah, I have a daughter who's a little bit like that way in herself. Uh-huh.
Well, you know what? It turns out that it was the right move for me.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. If you didn't do it to my sister and brother, I don't know why. I guess they didn't recognize value. What is the expression? This expression I really love, live big. What does that mean? And how can we, you know, use that today in a positive way? Live big. I like that.
Right. Well, I think live big is something that Fisk would say as a way to encapsulate this whole Winners Club and this idea of making the most of your life. I didn't touch on it earlier, but Fisk served in Vietnam and had a lot of his squad mates die. And so the way that he came up with this Winners Club was that he came back home and began teaching, and he found that his high school students had a lot of apathy, and they just weren't that driven in life and took a lot of what they had for granted, you know, and he'd just seen a lot of his squad mates die in Vietnam. So he founded the Winners Club to get people to really cherish their life and understand the opportunity that they have and make the most of it. So when he founded this Winners Club and thought about the, you know, live big and telling his students to live big, he thought of it in a positive way, and he does think of it in a positive way. And I think some people can make it positive and about hope and all these things, but I think there are some students, and there are certainly some people in the book as the plot unfolds, that don't take live big that way. They take it in a little bit more of a greedy sense, if you will. You know, for them, live big is kind of acquiring as much as you can and taking whatever you want and maybe having to trample over other people to get it. And so, you know, live big is something that I think Fisk throws out there to his students and his class as something to aspire to. And unfortunately, everybody has to take that their own way. And as the book unfolds, people do take that in different ways, and it has some tragic consequences.
Sounds like some things that I'm listening to on the news daily, seriously.
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
Yeah, live big and America's going to be great someday, who knows.
Right, yeah, all those words like big and great, they're kind of fraught with danger if you go too far down that road, for sure.
Yeah, that is definitely true. So we have Becky Brindle. I like Becky. And she sends a letter to all the others that Bob Fisk is missing. And Steph's voice is the loudest because she actually takes it seriously. Why would these students give up everything to find him and explain why he was so special? And the students really wanted his praise. I mean, you get one teacher like that, that it matters. And I know
right.
that.
Yeah, I mean, I think Bob Fisk, you know, just his personality, he's this sort of big, towering, commanding presence in the halls of the high school. He would kind of walk around through passing period and just kind of loom over the whole school. And if there was a bully that was bothering somebody, he'd grab them and stop them. He would, you know, he would do all kinds of these kind of big, splashy things. And I think that had an impact on the student. They certainly saw him as a person of principle and a person that whose approval they sought for that reason. But even beyond that, these winners, the people that he tapped as winners, he wouldn't just tell them that they were winners and that they should live big. He would do things out in their lives once they were out of high school to help them. I mean, it comes out in the plot that he's helped Eric in a very significant way when his tech company had a bit of a hiccup out there in the Bay Area. Lydia is somebody who he interceded for at some point when she was having trouble academically. So, and Steph, when she graduates, she's, you know, this big academic star. She's got a chance to go to Stanford or wherever she wants to go for undergraduate, and her parents don't want to let her go, and Fisk just refuses to accept it. And he storms into their living room and says he's going to pay for part of the tuition, and she's got to go. He's just not going to accept her not living her biggest life at this big university. So it's not just that he does it with oratory. He also gets involved in these people's lives and gives them material help. And I think when he goes missing and then Becky sends out the letter and they get together, each of the winners kind of in their own mind remembers those things that he's done for them and feels like, you know, boy, yeah, it's giving up a lot to miss work or miss a meeting, but, you know, look how much he's done for me. And so I think a lot of that stuff comes back when the winners group gets together, the stuff that he's done in the past to help them in their lives.
That is great, because how many students would even care? They figure, I got where I have to go, so now too bad.
Right, right.
Well, we have the principal. I don't like this guy
right.
at all. And he wants to fire him. I don't like
right.
him, you know, typical principal.
Yeah.
How does he react and why, and how does Steph convince him not to fire Bob? Because he can't
yeah,
fire Bob.
Yeah, so Principal Mancini is a kind of a by-the-book
yeah.
Principal. He wants things neat, and he doesn't want a lot of disturbances in his high school. And Bob Fisk is somebody who kind of invites controversy just by his very nature. There's a element where they were going to cut Latin early in Fisk's tenure, and he just refused to accept that, and he said that he would do the janitor's work to recoup the cost of the program, you know, and stuff like that for a principal who just wants to go along smooth and steady and not have a lot of drama. It bugs Mancini. I think also the principal feels like Bob Fisk is somebody that everybody looked up to and adored, and he was doing a lot of the dirty work in the school, making the trains run on time, and so didn't get a lot of the glory. So I think there's a little bit of jealousy there at play. So specifically on the issue of firing Fisk, Fisk has had an unexplained absence earlier in the school year. where he didn't show up to work for a few days. And we find out in the first part pretty quickly there where he was. But that's a bit of a mystery as the book opens. Where was Fisk earlier in the school year? And so Mantini says, well, he had one unexplained absence, and this is the second unexplained absence, and that's enough. It's in the district contract that I can fire him, and so I'm going to fire him. So he tells Steph flat out that he's going to fire Fisk. And Steph just won't accept it. She kind of draws on some of her business experience and some of her experience in advertising with talking people off of a cliff and getting clients to do what she wants. She kind of takes a soft approach and tries to bring him back. And so she gets the concession that he'll give them 24 hours to go out and find Fisk. If they don't find him in 24 hours, he's going to exercise that clause in the contract and fire Fisk. So she kind of wins that concession for them, to give them a little time to go out and do some research and try to track him down.
Well, she works for Nike. And
yeah, they work for an advertising company.
Tell us about that.
Right. So they work for an advertising company in Chicago, and the agency wants to work for Nike. I think probably any advertising agency in the country wouldn't work for Nike. They spend a lot of money selling their shoes and making ads. And the company and Steph's advertising company had never worked for Nike, and you know, being the achiever that Steph is, she went out and hustled a meeting with them, and did some research about, you know, where they might be willing to spend money. And as the book begins, she has this very important meeting the next day with Nike to present all of their materials and to show them what Dunham and Pryor, her advertising company, can do. And so when Bob Fisk goes missing, going to that meeting of Becky's and talking to the other winners and, you know, thinking about going after Fisk comes into conflict with her big meeting with Nike. And so she has a choice to make quickly there in the story about, is she going to make sure she gets to the Nike meeting, which she's worked so hard for and, you know, could be a big coup in her career, or is she going to go and help with Fisk? So she's got to choose that. She, like everything, Steph is balancing parenthood and career, and now Fisk is gone, which is certainly the last thing a busy parent needs. So so she's got a lot of tough influences pulling at her.
Well, then we come to something very interesting. Mm-hmm. We meet Doug. I don't want to say too much about Doug.
Right.
Yeah, I got that one. How did they proceed to find him? And her husband said, which I found kind of interesting, that he would go along. And then Steph needs some help with disciplining children, and that's where I can come in and help her, seriously. my nieces and nephews know, even though they're far away, don't mess with the aunt. Just do what she says. It works better. So
he doesn't
discipline Ella. Yeah, and Ella does the wrong thing, and she hardly explains to her what she did wrong. How come she lets this little girl get away with everything? That's not good. She's going to go off to be a very spoiled little person. So,
right. I think there are a couple scenes there where we see that. And I think, I think that stuff, like a lot of parents, especially busy parents, sometimes deals with that tough choice about, do you handle a situation in the expedient way, you know, the way that's going to kind of get us on our way and move us, you know, get us in the car and get us where we need to go so you can go about and do what you need to do? Or do you kind of bite the bullet and have the confrontation and really discipline them in a thorough way? And I think as the story starts, that does happen, that Steph isn't able to take the hard road with Ella. And I think certainly there's the risk that, you know, with everything else going on, she's not taking enough of those stands and disciplining her kid. And I think Steph has anxiety about that. I think there's a scene towards the end of the first part there where something's happened with Ella at preschool, some bad behavior. And it probably flowed downstream from some of those decisions, exactly what you're talking about. And I think and Steph has this moment where she realizes, God, you know, we're just not there enough. We just, you know, we do what we can. We send her to a fancy preschool with, you know, fancy things, but we're not spending enough time, and she kind of beats herself up about that. And so I think, well, you know, again, not going too far into the story, but I think as we move on from the conclusion of the story, I think there's hope for Steph that some of these things may turn around with the new outlook she's got after all these kind of cataclysmic things have happened in the story and with Fisk.
She was lucky they didn't throw her out of nursery school. I know. So, she leaves them to find Fisk. How does she figure out where he might be? And why does Jane follow them, too? I mean, oh, my God. What was
right,
her point
I mean,
of going along? Seriously.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to go too far into
the mechanics
of what happens. But I will say that Steph does go to great lengths. She goes way out of her comfort zone to figure out where Fisk might be. And she does get up, find a clue that eventually gets the winners on the track of Fisk. And she goes way out of her comfort zone. There's a scene where Doug kind of becomes aware or is told what she's done, and he can't believe it either. You know, it is a place, you know, in a novel where, you know, a protagonist is really stretched to do something that she would have never thought. You know, she's a big rule follower, and she breaks some rules, again, without going into it. She breaks a lot of rules to get this clue, but she gets it, and there they go. And for Jane's part, you know, Jane Brockert is a very kind of hard-charging person. She's got that same type A personality, the same one that drove Nora and couldn't accept that Nora didn't want to be a winner. And it's the same with, you know, finding her daughter. I mean, there's bad, but there's also good to it. You know, she's a mother bear. You know, when her daughter's missing, there's nothing that she won't do to go after. So she does, she kind of tails the winners and there's a thing that she says when she catches up with the winners that will spark their, you know, being able to make a breakthrough in the case. Again, I don't want to say too much, but I think they both Steph and Jane both have their own kind of personal things going on that lead them to take such extraordinary steps in the search.
This is very true. And this is a murder mystery, and somebody gets killed. That's all I'll say about that. So, who is Detective Wright? And he thought he had the right person, and he wanted the person. You know, I've read like I close to 9,000 mystery thrillers that I've done in the last 9 years. I'm serious. My husband counted them when he transferred my reviews over to my new computer. He said, "Are you seriously telling me that I read that many books?" Yeah. So, I mean,
wow.
I know the motives of. I could be able to write one of these, but I wouldn't even attempt. So. The police don't always care. They just want to get the person so they can say, guess what, I got the person. So Detective Wright thinks he has a suspect. How come he doesn't want to look any further?
Yeah, I think the reason that he doesn't go much further, I think part of it is that that the facts in front of him, when he looks at it, they seem so buttoned up and airtight that he really he thinks – you know, I think like a lot of people, you know, he's got myopia and it just feels like this has got to be it. And it speaks to a little bit the forces behind the crime and how thorough and skillfully this scheme has been contrived, that the detective looks at what's in front of him and just doesn't see another possibility than this person who's sitting across the desk from him, who was right there near the murder or the crime or the accident, whatever it is that happens there at about the 1/3 point. So he's just looking what's in front of him. He just doesn't see another explanation. And unfortunately, I don't know if, you know, whether it's incompetence or laziness, he's not able to see that past that, even when this person brings to light other information that perhaps should have put him on a different path.
Sometimes, like you said, they don't want to be blindsided by their own whatever.
Right.
When they find the key piece behind, what happened to Fisk and what do we learn about Autumn and him? I don't want to say too much about that, but what Autumn, poor thing, why?
Right. I don't think it's giving away too much to say that one of Fisk's students does go missing shortly after he goes missing. And that becomes a big part of the story about why Fisk, you know, this 75-year-old dinosaur with this winner's club, you know, has had this association with a student, and a female student, and why this student has gone missing. And so there's a lot of speculation among the winners and in the media and with the police about the nature of that relationship, and people jump to all kinds of conclusions. And And, yeah, different information dribbles out over the course of the plot about the nature of the relationship between Fisk and Ottoman, what they were doing together, why they might have been together. You know, I think people in the media and the police and people who don't know Fisk jump to the obvious conclusion that, you know, there's something really untoward there. But Steph really believes firmly in Fisk, and she won't be shaken off of that. And the other winners, to a greater or lesser extent, also have faith in Fisk. And so they really fight hard to hold on to this picture of Fisk that they had as this kind of paragon of good, you know, in the face of these accusations that build from other people.
Well, sometimes people just see things the way they want to see them, even though they're not really real.
Right, that's for sure.
What can I say? At least my students think I'm perfect till this day. What can I tell you?
Right.
I know. Well, they face me on Facebook all the time, so I must have done something right.
No. I think so. There you go, Facebook, yeah.
Yeah, so why does Steph need this approval and confirmation that she's a winner? And why should it matter if somebody puts her down? Because we've all had people that try to knock us down. We just have to not let them do it.
Right. I think that's definitely true. And I think that Steph, you know, I think Fisk, you know, had such a big impact on her when she was young that she still sees him as somebody who's a towering influence who she needs to please. It's not really the book doesn't go into this explicitly, but Steph did lose her father early in life. We find that out early. And I think, you know, you can imagine that Fisk, you know, has filled a little bit of a father figure role there, not so much in the things that he's done, but just mentally for her. So she definitely feels this need to kind of please him. And I think another aspect of the plot that comes out is that Fisk didn't have a large relationship with Steph out of college the way that he did with other winners like Eric and Lydia. So, and that nags at Steph too. She feels like, well, hasn't Fisk gotten involved in my life post college? They do have one conversation where, you know, he expresses some doubts about her career choice of advertising. But I think that the absence of that praise from him after college, you know, in those post-college years also, I think, kind of drives her to crave that attention. Just, you know, when it's something that we expect to get and we don't get it, it's something that you want. And so, you know, and on the point of, you know, it mattering about people, you know, putting her down, I think, you know, that's a tough question for everybody. I mean, Steph is, you know, in her late 20s. She's still figuring it out. She's still, you know, a young adult, and I like to think that, again, as we get past the events of the story and into the future, that maybe she's gained some perspective and won't worry so much about what people think there and won't take a lot of that criticism to heart. She'll kind of have a little more inner strength to make her own path.
I think a lot of young people are like that. And
right.
I grew up, you know, my mother used to say, well, you know, you have to worry about what people think. I said, basically, you know, you have to worry about what you think. And if you can look in the mirror and say to yourself, I'm a wonderful person, I'm doing the best I can, to me that's fine. It's when they compare you to other people and your friends that you say, oh, I don't want to be like that anymore. I'm going to be somebody else. And that's when I find that kids, even the students I work with, you know, turn the other in the other direction. That bothers me.
Right, and I, you know, I feel even that way as a writer. You know, I mean, I've been writing for a long time, and the Winner Makers received a lot of really positive professional reviews. But if I, you know, have a reader leave a, you know, and I've had a couple of somebody who just really didn't like a certain thing about the book, or, you know, it is hard, no matter how much perspective you've gained over the years, not to have somebody say, you know, a bad thing about you and not take it to heart and not just kind of feel that sting, even though kind of intellectually you know that you don't need to pay attention to that. And, you know, this book, you know, everybody comes at a book with different expectations, and the Winner Maker is not going to please every single reader who picks up, you know, who wants a thriller. People, there are all kinds of thrillers. And but you still, you know, you still feel that. I think it's part of being human, and all you can do is continue to work forward toward, you know, seeing those things in context and being able to do that. But I think, you know, that instinct to care about what other people think is, boy, it's a hard one to shake.
Yeah, I learned that. You know, I wrote my first Faces Behind the Stone series book, and I got a whole bunch of 5 stars and 4 stars, whatever. And then somebody gave it 2 stars, and the reason was I didn't understand the book and I didn't finish it.
Right, right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
and I just said,
review.
Maybe if you finished it and got and went to remedial reading, you would understand it. And I just cracked up laughing. You know,
right.
You can't. I cracked up. I said, yeah, you didn't understand something so simple. Well, what could you do?
Right.
But
right.
We have another
yeah.
person, Eric. I mean, a lot of people, a lot of kids face this. So Eric needs to face his past. And why
right.
believe the cutting words of others? How come he needed to face his past? He's a dark character, too. I like him, though. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, I think Eric, you know, he's achieved a lot since he got out of high school and college, but there's still that part of him. There's still that kind of middle school kid who worries that he's too skinny or couldn't do a pull-up in gym class. You know, he still kind of feels the
mm-hmm.
eyes of, you know, the other kids on him. And so, again, it's the same thing where, you know, intellectually he knows he shouldn't worry about, you know, what anybody else thinks of him. He knows that he's in this good place career-wise, and he's founded this company that's going to make all this money. But just emotionally, he's still kind of stuck back in high school. And I think some of the characters in The Wintermaker, this book is kind of an episode or an adventure that they have to use to exercise some of those high school demons. You know, one of the high school demons for Eric is his big crush on Steph. You know, he's got this big crush on Steph. He always has, and even though it seems like he would be past, he's had a pretty serious girlfriend for a few years. You know, once Steph's name is mentioned, you know, all this stuff from 10 years ago comes rushing back to his head, and he struggles to contain these kind of swelling emotions that he gets. So, I think in a lot of ways he's still fighting some of those high school confidence battles, you know, as the story goes on.
I know there are a lot of people like that in this world that never really grow up or never realize that it doesn't really matter.
Right.
And
right.
he wants, what is this thing about Steph that she's so wonderful? I mean, she's married, I know that. But
right.
That doesn't seem to bother him, and who cares about that, you know, what can I tell you? You know, you never know. And so what is it about her that he finds so wonderful, and is she attracted to him? I mean, what the heck?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the reasons that Steph, you know, Steph occupies this place in his mind on this big pedestal. You know, she's kind of the platonic
mm-hmm.
ideal of a woman to him. She's smart, she's attractive, she's sort of kind and nice. And I mean, for me, when I think about Eric's crush on Steph, I mean, I think about it in terms of Fisk and the Winners Club and this live big idea. I mean, if
mm-hmm.
you ever want to think about who is the live big woman, it would be Steph, you know, because she's kind of got all the pieces. She's, you know, there's, you know, she's straight down the middle, you know, checks all the boxes in Eric's mind. And so I think, you know, some of this drive and ambition to kind of get the best or be the best from Fisk, which has kind of seeped into his mind view from his time with Fisk, I think it feeds into his crush on Steph, you know. And it's still, again, as the book starts, it's still there. I mean, we learn as the book changes to his perspective briefly, you know, the damage it's done in his life out in San Francisco to have
mm.
Steph brought back into his life, you know, this kind of rash thing that, you know, again, I won't go into it, but, you know, it really has had this destructive impact that he can't kind of see Steph in perspective. As you said, she's married. He's still, you know, it's like a dog whistle hearing Steph and thinking about Steph and this place that he occupied in his mind, you know, 10 years ago. It's still there. It's still there kind of lurking for him.
Well, before I forget, Monday, this is going to be interesting. We have six authors at the same time. Seriously?
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we have Dick Belsky, Marcia Caswell Cook. We have Marilyn Levinson. We have Alan Topol, John Land, and Colin Eggers. And we're going to talk about how you name your character, how you name your villain, how you name their occupation, and how you name how they're killed. And that's just some of what my thoughts came. On Wednesday, we have the author of Mambo and Murder, Cindy McDonald. And on the 17th, Vincent Zandri, and we're going to talk about his Chase Baker series, I think, and Every Wicked Man, Stephen James, on the 20th. And that's how we're going to end 2018. 2019, I decided to try something different. January 8th, Pastor Michael Jones will talk about his Begin to Serve Foundation and how he helps people all over the world. And on the 10th, Vincent Zandri will be back with, he hasn't told me which book yet, because he has to send it, seriously. Well, we'll have a surprise, you never know. For those of you, Hanukkah is almost over, but, you know, presents, we take them all year long, and Christmas and Kwanzaa, so why don't you buy a few thousand copies of The Winnemaker by Jeff Bond, or Read and Gone, or Victoria Templeton by Marcia Castle Cook, that's really hot, let me tell you, Imposter's Law, Yesterday's News by Dick Belsky, and just go on Amazon and, as a matter of fact, why don't you just go on my Just Review site and see what I reviewed and just buy one of everything. I only reviewed 300 books, you know, last year. So, you know, you never know what you're going to find. You never know. So, the truth is, how is the truth unraveled? And what does Lydia reveal about the past that might explain stuff in the future, in the present? Because everybody's got a past in this book, which is really cool.
Right, right. So, Lydia Brocker is the fourth winner that is part of the Winners Search Club. Her family, the Brockerts, you know, we talked about Jane Brockert, her mother, who's kind of hard-charging. Lydia is kind of the opposite, or at least you might think of that. She seems shy, at least at the beginning of the story. Her older sister, Nora, who we've spoken about, died her senior year, which was also the senior year of Steph and Eric and Doug, in a drowning at prom. And that is a mystery that is lurking in the back of the story throughout. And Lydia was a sophomore when her older sister died, and there's some question about what impact her older sister's drowning at prom had on Lydia. Did it force her down into a shell or something different? And that becomes important for the story about that prom night drowning and exactly how Lydia took it, and did it play a role in her, you know, kind of going into the shell and going into academic research about anxiety. It's something that, as the book starts, Lydia is very shy and the other winners can't get a lot out of her, and they wonder what, you know, what's she thinking, you know, does her family history have anything to say about the events that are going on? And so as the story plays out, she opens up a little bit, and the winners, to a different extent, are able to pull out some of that secret and find out how it bears on the things going on with Fisk.
Why does Jane insist that they call the police? And what happens when they confront the truth? She's a hot character, this one. Let me tell you.
Right, right. I mean, Jane, you know, when we get to the point in the plot where the police may or may not be called in, you know, Jane, all she wants back is her daughter, Autumn. You know, her daughter is the student that Fisk has had this association with and is missing. Jane doesn't care, you know, if Fisk is blamed for something or not blamed for it. She doesn't care if the people who come to her, you know, if their lives are going to be affected or if they're going to, something's going to get pinned on them or not. She just wants her daughter back, and I think we can all understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But she's not, you know, any character in the book who comes to Jane expecting some kind of deference or that she's going to accommodate them is going to be disappointed, because Jane just wants her daughter back, and the second she thinks that the police are the shortest path to that happening, she's going to call the police. She's going to pick up the phone and dial 911. So she's a character that is just single-minded in that way about her kids and her kids' safety.
You can't blame her. You really
can't blame her.
You
certainly can't. No.
Well, tell us a little bit more about Doug. What does he stick around for? I don't like that.
About
one.
Doug?
Yeah. How come he sticks around? Really, seriously.
Yeah, I mean, I think Doug is, you know, Doug has a connection to Coach Fisk. For him, it's Coach Fisk because Fisk was the football coach at the high school, and Doug was the star quarterback. So Doug has some allegiance there. But, you know, Doug is the husband of Steph, who's kind of our main protagonist. And, you know, Doug is a little bit too cool for school. You know, I think he's not going to be too mushy about his association with Fisk. You know, Steph really wants to stick up for Fisk and think that Fisk couldn't have done anything wrong. And Doug says, you know, who knows? You know, he might have. You know, we didn't know him that well.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, we don't know him anymore, which is true because it's 10 years later. Certainly Fisk could have changed. So Doug, you know, has this kind of a little more of a cool, detached view of the mystery as the book starts. And I think, you know, I'm not going to talk too much about the plot, but I think he sticks around with the search, in part, you know, because he's married to Steph, and that, you know, we're all, you know, those of us that are married or have been married know that,
mm-hmm.
you know, when your spouse wants you to do something and expects you to do something, you know, there's a certain obligation to do that, and I think that's part of his allegiance, you know, part of his kind of lip service to his spouse, and part of it is, you know, is perhaps he has other reasons for, you know,
mm-hmm.
for wanting to stick up for Fisk, you know, so... plenty of characters here have
mm-hmm.
have things to hide or things about their association with Fisk that they're not being upfront about as the book begins. That's true of it. Well, I think maybe all four winners I think have something about their relationship with Fisk we don't know it, as the winners group meets, and it will unfold as the story goes.
Yeah, I know, and that's what makes it so exciting because. No one is who they really seem to be, and that's what makes
right.
it greater. Because if everybody was just so transparent, it would have made it easier to figure it out. And I won't tell anybody if I did, because I'm really good at this after a while. How did you create the final scenes with the videos? And, I mean, that was interesting. I'm going like, whoa. I felt
right.
like I was watching a movie. How did you create that? Because this is good, and then I have I'm sitting with my pen asking, adding more questions here. This is really good.
Yeah,
I keep doing this.
Well, I think with the finale, you know, I tried to step back and think about a climax that would bring each of the winners into
mm-hmm.
it in a way that was appropriate for their character. You know, obviously Eric is a tech guy, and so. You know, he's a data recovery person. That's his startup. So, you know, I think the climax needed to utilize that. You know, certain characters are very determined. And I think that determination needed to come into the climax. So, you know, a lot of kind of brainstorming about how to make that come about. I think to pull back the curtain a little bit as a writer, you know, when the end of the book gets there and you want to show the machinations of how the events have unfolded, what the plot was, you know, you've got to give people a ride. You want it to be a satisfying climax that is thrilling and reveals everything that happened, but at the same time, you know, be realistic, you know, and maybe in, you know, 95% of real life cases like this, the truth would come out from a detective just talking to a witness, you know, a week after the thing happened. But that's not what we want in a novel. You know, we want to see it. We want our protagonist to uncover the truth. And so that's how, you know, and so this is what I came up with you know, the video that you're talking about. It's just to try to find a thrilling, satisfying way to show readers what went on and what was the truth. You know, again, trying to be realistic with it, but also giving people a good ride.
Well, you did because, you know, you could feel the tension in the characters.
Right.
I can feel the tension in the plot. And if I didn't, you'd know it. No. but those of you that haven't read my review, you know, I like to do things like the day before so I don't forget.
Yeah.
And because I had technical difficulties all over the place, I posted your review on Amazon. And thank God they loved it because they said, thank you for reviewing the Widowmaker because
right.
sometimes they get in. I don't know what their problem is, and I don't care.
Right.
And my review's on Just Reviews. And Cheryl, I'm going to email it to you so that you could be my brilliance. And hopefully everybody will like it. So, if Steph could speak again, would she do this over again the same way? Would she go after Fisk? And what about Eric? Would they do it again?
Yeah, I love this question. As I was looking over your questions, I really love it. I think this question gets to the heart of Steph's character and of the whole book's themes.
Mm-hmm.
I think Steph would. I think she would go after Steph. I think for Steph, the process of looking for Fisk, of finding out, you know, who was the true Fisk, you know, what were the things driving him, and also discovering, you know, what the Winners Club did, you know, what it did to her, what it did to the people around her, students, friends, and things like that. I think that process and that discovery
mm-hmm.
really helped her take a step back and reassess things, reassess her life. And I think after seeing all that and seeing everything that this kind of ambition-heavy club has wrought, I think it lets her see her own life in perspective. It lets her think about her family and her job and everything else around her and see how big, you know, there's that word again, how kind of big that stuff really is, even though it, you know, maybe it's not big in the way that a famous politician or an astronaut is big. But I think the whole process has helped her see all that in perspective. And I think going forward, she's going to make her own decisions about what happiness is. You know, she's not going to let other people's expectations for her drive, you know, her own thoughts about happiness. And for Eric, you know, I don't think there's any way Eric could have not jumped into it. You know, once he heard that Steph, his old crush, was involved, it just, you know, he's like a somebody with an itch. He just, there was no way he was not going to go for it. And as I said earlier, I think the obsession with Steph was just a demon that he had to exercise. I think for better or worse, he was going to go after it and see what came of him. You know, I think, you know, he was somebody, we talked about people that kind of don't grow up and never get past high school. Mm-hmm. I hope Eric is past high school at this point now, but I do think that getting together with kind of the old high school gang and, you know, the jocks and the geek and all that, to kind of have it out there, get back in, mix it up, you know, one last time and have it out, for better or worse. I think it helped him. I think he got past it. I think he's ready to go on with kind of a more enlightened adult life, you know, where maybe some of these pettinesses and some of these small concerns are behind him. I think we can hope that as we move on from the end. But so, yeah, I think they both would have done it. I mean, obviously there were all kinds of things in each of their personal lives that had to just sort of had to come out and had to play out. And I like to think of them as being in a better place as the book ends.
Well, I hope so. You know, I was sitting here with my pen writing. Seriously, this is the type of book that young adults can read. College students.
Right.
Seriously, and I'm looking at, there's a lot of lessons that they can learn from this book. What would you say?
Right.
I mean, you could actually go into college classes and students and even high school kids that are graduating, and they can learn a lot from, you know, thinking for themselves and being their own person. And then you've got teachers that tell them, trust me, I know, oh, you should be like this one, or you compare them to that one. You don't compare people to other people. So what would you say that if college students were reading this, what would you hope they would take from reading this book? I just wrote that. I don't know where.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, in the same way, along the same lines of kind of Steph's lesson, I think, you know, for me, the thing that you ought to take from it, you know, if you're a young person, is just that, you know, living big and achieving is something that you can do without being, you know, an astronaut or, you know, the mayor of your town or something like that. It's something that, living big is and having a worthwhile, fulfilling life is something that's available to everybody, you know, in whatever circumstance you find yourself. I mean, you know, we're all starting for different places, but it's not even about, you know, how far you move up from your current station in life or anything, because you can stay in the same place your whole life or you know, move down socioeconomically or up or whatever. But if you're enjoying the people around you and the things around you, you know, you can live big in that way, you know. And you don't need to think about how other people view that success. You don't need to worry about all these successes that you aren't having, or these goals that, you know, maybe you set or somebody else set for you and that you didn't get to. You know, that's not what it's about. You know, it's about looking around you and enjoying the successes that you have, that you're having every day.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, there are a lot of people that, you know, when I was 3 years old, my mother told me I was going to be an educator. Seriously, there I was, 36 years later. What I try to explain to my nieces and nephews and anyone out there, any young people, is you have to pick a career that when you get up in the morning, you're not going to want to say, I want to go back to sleep and never go out. You have to pick something that fits you and that you want to do every single day. And if it's not something that you picked, it's somebody that's forcing you to do it, then don't do it.
I once had somebody say to me that, you know, when you're thinking about what you want to do for your job, think about what you want to do, what you like to do on the weekends, and find a way to make that your job. You know? Yeah, you try to find something that really works for you, you know, that you're going to want to do every morning.
Well, I'll tell you what. And I retired, I decided to do this.
I do it.
I don't charge for reviews. Sometimes for the radio show. But basically, it's a lot of fun. And it's just something different. And when you retire from a career, you don't want to sit home and become a couch potato, which is what was happening. I was over 200 pounds at one point. I'm 109 pounds of nothing. And
right.
So if she learned, if Steph learned one thing, what would she change in the future and why? If she could send a message out there to young people or whatever, what would she say to young people? And then I have another question that I'm writing as I'm doing what I can here.
Yeah, I think she would tell young people to just focus on the things around you, you know. I think mm-hmm. and you know, not necessarily live big, but you know, look more circumspectly around you and look at the small things around you, and you know, have you know bring positivity to, you know, your children, your family, and want great things for them, but don't define great in kind of the narrow scope of, you know, achievement and kind of, you know, elevating yourself above other people. You know, don't think about that. You know, get rid of that kind of, you know, relative success scale that's kind of out there floating in the ether. You know, take yourself off of that and really focus on the things right around you and making yourself happy with your everyday surroundings.
Well, I have to tell you that we're tweeting your review is being tweeted all over Twitter now.
Okay, thank you. That's great to hear. Yeah, I'm a debut author. I'm very dependent on kind of word of mouth and everything. So I'm very grateful for all the help getting the word out about the story.
Well, for people that are listening, the buy link is on my Facebook wall. The review is there. It's on Twitter. It's on LinkedIn. It's everywhere. That's just what I do. What can I say? So, one more question. We have about time for two more questions. If Fisk could speak, would he be happy that they did this? What would he say in regard to all of these people that are looking for him? What would he say if he can, you know, if he could be known? We're not going to say if he is known. Look, what would he say?
Right. Oh boy, that's a tough one. Yeah. I mean, I think he would. Yeah, I mean, you know, he's a character, even all the way to the end. I mean, I wrote him as with the idea that some people would look at him and feel he was a positive influence and a fountain of knowledge, and other people would think the contrary. So I think it kind of depends on how you peg him. I mean, I think he does, you know, he looks at all the publicity around him, and I think there's a titillation there for him, or would mm-hmm. be for him in the hypothetical, that he would be excited about everybody examining his kind of body of work over the course of his teaching career mm-hmm. and thinking about it and having downstream impacts and having people talk about him. But, you know, I think there's also a part of him that would have a little bit of shame about the consequences the obvious consequences as the book closes about what, how people have taken his advice perhaps differently than he thought, you know. And over the course of many decades, I think, you know, mm-hmm. his message probably morphed and changed, and maybe he lost sight of that original good and pure message that he had after Vietnam, you know, of just wanting kids to cherish mm-hmm. their lives. And you could make the case that it kind of morphed and became a little more sinister over the years as achievement and some of these things crept into it and kind of hardened it, calcified it to a form that maybe he didn't intend at the beginning.
So where can everybody find out about you, your work, and what's next?
Sure,
and
sure.
And I think you should bring some of these people back.
Yeah, my website is jeffbondbooks.com, just my name, jeffbondbooks.com. You know, you can find any news, you can get in touch with me. If anybody has any questions about the book, I'm always happy to hear from readers. The contact me form there, just send an email right to me. I love hearing from readers. I've already heard from a few since launch and interacted with them. The next book I've got coming out, it releases on May 15th. It's a little more of a go-go action thriller. You know, The Wintermaker has a lot of character-driven stuff. It's called Black Quest 40, and it's kind of it's about a software company that gets locked down for a 40-hour corporate training exercise. They lock down the office. They say they collect everybody's phone. Nobody can use a phone. Nobody can use the Internet. Everybody's going to sleep on cots for two nights. until this big mysterious software project gets built. It's kind of a twist on the Die Hard formula, you know, with Bruce mm-hmm. Willis in there fighting these people who have taken over a big office building. But instead of Bruce Willis, we have this young, very opinionated female engineer. She's kind of like this engineering savant. She's really fed up with corporate culture. She's a fish out of water in an office building. She grew up homeless on the streets of San Francisco. And so I think it's kind of a modern Die Hard where instead of Bruce Willis and throwing chairs at people, she's this engineering savant, so she has this drone that goes on and fights for and does all these things. So she's fighting to get out of the building. But you can read the synopsis on my website. Mm-hmm. You can also go to my Amazon author page, and it's available for pre-order, so you can read the synopsis there. As I said, I like to write a little bit cross-genre. The Wintermaker is, you know, character-driven, but also has a lot of suspense and fast-paced stuff. Black Quest 40 is going to be a little more on the fast-paced action adventure scale. I think on the scale of thrillers, I still think that the characters are very interesting, and Deb, particularly this young female engineer who is a fish out of water in corporate America, she's got a lot. She's very interesting, but it is a little more of a go-go thriller. Some of the books that I'll be releasing later in the next year or so are going to be a little more on the literary side. So you can read about some of those other books that I have in the pipeline also on my website. So I do plan to start putting a good number of stories out there, and Wintermaker is just number one.
Well, are you going to do another blog tour with Cheryl? Because you really should, because I can't wait to finish my next book, if I ever get done writing it, ever. My next book is going to be called Silenced Voices, and it's about people whose voices were silenced by other people. And hopefully I'll write it. I have 3 more stories to write, but I want a preview copy of this new one. Seriously.
Absolutely. I would love to send you a
preview
copy.
And if you do a blog
show
with Cheryl, just make sure she says that you want an interview. Cheryl, you know.
Yes,
I absolutely will. Okay, so
yeah,
I want to thank you so very much.
Yeah, and thank you so much, Fran, for having me. I was thrilled that this is the first kind of radio interview I've done, so, and it was a great experience. I really enjoyed the opportunity to come on and talk about The Wintermaker and to get to know you a little bit better, Fran. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Anytime, everybody, it's sunny outside. It's not raining. It's beautiful. It's 20 degrees out there. It's really cold. I don't know how cold it is by you, but I know it's like really, really cold. It's 32 degrees. It went up 1 degree. What can I say? The wind is very strong, but I don't care. The sun is shining. Everybody have a nice day, and bye.
Thank you, Fran. Bye-bye.